Now, this is no joke. This ain't April Fool's Day.
No.
But we're getting loads of calls. Just in the last 10 or 15 minutes, what's happening?
It was a weird sensation about maybe 2 or 3 minutes ago. I was sat in the bed and all of a sudden I just felt as if, it sounded first of all as if there was a thunder directly above the house. But at the same time, it wasn't like thunder. It was as if we started vibrating. I know that sounds stupid, but it was a really, really weird sensation.
And obviously quite frightening.
But it happened so fast.
Yeah, Martina is on the line as well. Hi, Martina.
Hi, Tommy.
Good morning. You're in Glengad.
Good morning. Glengad, yes.
So tell me what happened in your house in the last 5 minutes.
Well, it's just about 5 minutes ago. We were just lying in bed here. Myself and my daughter was just talking, and next minute the whole thing just shook. We thought actually it was a wagon or a bus that passed the house, so I ran to the front door to see was there anything passing, and there was nothing. It just shook for a couple of seconds, and then it was so quick, as that lady said, it was just gone in a couple of seconds.
Broadcasting live to the west of Ireland, this is Midwest Radio's main lunchtime news. News as it happens across the region.
4-magnitude earthquake off the Belmullet coast this morning has been described as surprisingly large by the Geological Survey of Ireland.
Surprisingly large earthquake for the Irish area at 2 minutes to 9, about 80, 90 kilometres west of Belmullet.
Listeners across the west reported tremors and loud noises just before 9 a.m.
There is a sense of fear out there that I've never witnessed in my life. It has reached this stage now where if there is a private function, a wedding, a funeral, an anniversary, and any other public event, that vigilante groups are now operating in the interests of the public at large, and they're also operating in the interests of, you know, former victims as well.
You also said people are dusting down firearms that they hadn't used for a very long time, and that would be of concern.
Well, more and more people in rural Ireland are waiting for an unwelcome bang on the door or a broken window. And to that extent, all bedrooms are now being locked. But old licensed firearms that haven't been used for years, sometimes for generations, are being dusted down, and people are ready for an unpleasant experience, and they will shoot, and it's not good, and it's not in the best interest of good policing either that this is happening. But people are now taking the law into their own hands, and I'm quite convinced, unfortunately, that somebody or some persons will be shot.
Yeah, but look at me. I sensed straight away when that was happening, this is a person who you're very close to, but I don't think that this is your mother or like your grandmother or anything like that.
No.
But I sensed this is kind of a favourite of yours. What I mean that by that, sometimes we have a favourite person in our life. Like, this is like a favourite of yours. This is definitely a person related to you. This is kind of like your favourite auntie. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, oh my
yes.
God.
And I also sense... Also, when she passed, she was kind of holding this portion of her body here. I don't know what that means, but does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she had cancer actually of the esophagus.
Yeah, yeah. So she was holding her, yeah. Like a breathing issue. Mm-hmm. I sensed that as well. And there was also another name coming through there, and I don't know who this other person is, but Paddy. She kept going on about Patrick or Paddy. Now, you might not know who... This could be a person relevant to you or her. You'll figure it out later. You can put it up on Facebook or Twitter. But she kept going on about Paddy or Paddy. He's got a back problem, and he needs to address that.
Okay.
I want you to just have a look. I don't know if there's anything on the other side of that, because... as everybody here saw, it was the pencil moving on its own inside the handkerchief. But if there's writing on that, I want you to read it silently to yourself first and then just see, does it make any sense? Is there writing on it first?
Yes.
Okay, so writing has appeared on it. Read it silently to yourself.
Does that make sense, Angelina?
I'm actually a little bit upset. That's amazing, yeah.
Something is written on the other side. It was blank.
Yeah. I might get someone else to read it if I can't, yeah.
Do you want her to go ahead and read it, Keith?
If she can read it. Yeah.
I've worked in radio for 11 years. I've never become upset on the air like this, not even when Mayo nearly won in All-Ireland. But anyway, dear Angeline, I'm with you always. Tomorrow I will send you another message from above. Thank you for all. You showed me your guardian angel, Mary Jo.
Oh my God. Oh, my God. That is incredible. That is absolutely incredible.
And so I would like to think that everything I do is a prayer. Now, I love to sing, Tommy. And I have so many songs that are a prayer. And I love you so. The people ask me how. When I'm out, when I go for a walk, isn't it a gorgeous prayer? Who wrote the song? My favourite, Perry Como. I want to give my love to you completely. Another beautiful song. I beg of you and listen to my heart. I've never prayed like this before. And then you have Christ beneath at either hand, Christ behind before me stand, Christ with me wherever I go, Christ around, above, below. I will meet people who will come in here. Met somebody the other day who was depressed. I said, come for a laugh. Pieta House, collecting funds for it. There's a Pieta House here, Tommy, in Kilmartin Road.
I had a thought one day. I was drinking at the time, and it came into my mind. Now, I was not drunk at all. I mean, I only had maybe a couple of drinks on me at that stage. And that's the thing to understand about the link with alcohol and suicide, is like, you only need to take two or three or four drinks for your impulse control to be lowered, because you'll start thinking or making decisions that you wouldn't normally entertain. So I thought, yeah, I'll end it. And once I had actually made that decision in my mind, everything changed completely. Everything lifted. The bad feelings, the hurt, the despair, the worry, the hiding, it all just lifted. And looking back on it now, I mean, it's a bit weird to be talking about it, but I mean, it was just unreal. And I thought, oh my God, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. And I did. And I remember that day vividly. I had a couple of more drinks, but I was not drunk on that day. I went home. I had a bath. I put on my favourite clothes. And I took a drug overdose, and I lay on the bed, and I waited for it to end. And I can honestly say at that moment in time that it was the happiest I'd been in a long, long, long time. And I am conscious that there's people listening to this, you know, they might be bringing up stuff for them, but that's just the way it was. I didn't think of anybody else, you know, and sometimes you'd hear it like, you know, it's an awful selfish thing to do. I don't think it's an awful selfish thing to do personally. I think it's an awful violent thing to oneself. But that didn't come into it at all. And luckily, I was found. I was found by my mother. And she dragged me to hospital. And we were then in an unreal experience for the next 2 to 3 weeks that involved me being in A&E, involved me being in coronary care because I came very, very close to death, involved me being in a psychiatric unit because I was a danger to myself. And I remember snippets of that. And I remember thinking, being very, very scared at one point, you know, because it dawned on me what I'd done and the enormity of it. I remember being awful, awful upset when people came to see me. I remember my friends coming in and having a conversation with me in the hospital, and it's like, what do you say to somebody who's just tried that? Like, but my friends and my family just talked to me like I was. And then somebody came and approached me who had been familiar with Hope House. I didn't even know of his existence, to be honest with you. And he was a friend. He was a friend of the family. He was a man who'd know death a lot. He was an undertaker. And he came and he suggested it, and I came here. And I suppose really what came out of it for me was safety. Is the only thing, I mean, if you ask something, what did I get out of this? It was safety. A place to be able just to talk about what was going on.
Delia, an awful lot of people would be surprised that at 101 years of age, you actually know how to use a computer. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know. I'd made up my mind that I was used to watching them around poking at it here. And I just felt that I'd like to do it. And there was nothing that I couldn't do. And then lots of things that I had to do. But there is one thing I found it difficult. But at the same, I managed it.
You have your own laptop?
I have, yes. And
can you send an email?
Not yet. I can't come to as far as writing the address, but I have no addresses to write to.
If Mayo do win, well, it will round off what's been a pretty good day for John so far. He got to meet his idol, his hero, Marty Morrissey. Got a photograph taken with him. He was like a child on a school tour.
We swapped numbers, Mike, too.
And you swapped numbers, and you also got a free ice cream. It's been a great day so far.
Indeed. I went for an iceberg instead of the Magnums. I thought the Magnum might leave me a bit messy and I wouldn't be able to talk properly. So it's been a great day. All we need now is a Mayo victory.
Now, we spoke to the emergency services there about what faces them when they're called out to the scene of a road collision. But thereafter, there are other people involved that I think sometimes we forget about. And one of those group of people is the undertakers, who are, I suppose, in many cases left to face the families of the loved one who has lost their life in a traffic accident. Probably the first face-to-face contact for the family will be the guards, and the next will be the undertaker. And I'm joined by David McGowan. David has been a funeral director in County Mayo for how long now, David?
I'm practicing for about 30 years now, Tommy.
Okay, so you know what you're talking about.
I have a fair idea, yeah.
Thanks for joining us. How difficult is it when it's a road traffic fatality?
It's not the nicest scene you could ask for. You'd be better off anywhere else. But it's a job that has to be done, and like the lads previous told you, you know, you have to build yourself up for that. When the Gardaí have finished, when they're called out to a crime scene, the Gardaí will be probably the first people to call, then the ambulance, and then you have the fire brigade in case they have to be cut out and stuff like that. A doctor then has to come. So there's a whole event of scenes. And the rule is here at the moment, if, because I get this from families a lot, because they don't understand what happens at an accident. And they'd ask, who brought my daughter, who brought my son away? Well, the situation in Ireland at the moment is, if when the doctor is called to the scene, he pronounces the body dead. The ambulance is not allowed to bring that person into the hospital. The reasons that's for is somebody 10 miles down the road might be suffering from a heart attack that would need that ambulance so to save his life. So it's usually the guards will call the funeral director once the body is pronounced dead on the scene. So we will arrive on the scene and you will have all the lights, the lads will be there, the ambulances. So it's pretty horrific. And then you'll see a body laid out on the road, and the ambulance lads or the fire brigade will usually have a blanket over the deceased person. At that stage, the news is starting to filter through who the person is, how it happened, and all of that. So you're there standing listening to that. And you see the guards running around trying to help out. Everybody feels the pain of this, because now that guard has to go and break the news to the family. I'm looking at a body on the road with a blanket over it. I know, and I know all the lads previous to you, no matter how much we do to help those people, we can't undo this horrific scene. So we just have to try and help the families out. So that's our initial contact, that we have to transfer that deceased person to the hospital. And I'm going to bring a body bag today, because some young people don't know what a body. We place that body in a body bag. And we bring it. Now, if you think of that young person that was out socialising that night, did they ever think for 1 minute that they'd end up in a body bag? And those are the thoughts that goes through my mind, because you see them with their Oogle boots on, their phones with them, their handbag with them, and all the little personal effects. We have to gather those up, put them into the bag and transfer them to the hospital. What happens then is the Gardaí will make the horrific job of notifying the people. And under normal circumstances, when somebody passes away, it could be 2 to 4 hours before they make the call to you and you continue on with the arrangements. In a road fatality accident or somebody killed, it could be 2 days before that call has been. Because once that's announced to the family that their loved one, their kids have been killed, they don't believe it. It's a dream. And the one thing they don't want to do is pick up a phone and ring a funeral director. They're in denial. And once they make that call to me, that's final. So it's normally not the immediate family that makes that call, but it's because they can't pluck the courage up to make that call. It's usually a relative, friend, neighbour of somebody in the marriage. And they will not come to the funeral home, from my experience. They expect you. Because again, it's final. And I usually go out to the house after 2 days. And as I approach the gate of that house, there's knots going in my stomach. I don't know what to expect. When I go into the house, if I don't know the family, it's very hard to identify who the parents are. Because there are groups of people all in corners and everybody is feeling the grief. It's a lot harder when I know the people. I don't know what to say. And here I am trying to get this family to make funeral arrangements. They still can't believe it has happened. They know their son or daughter is above in the morgue in Castlebar or whatever morgue. But the only question they won't speak to me. In fact, they don't want to see my face. They don't want to see me coming near the place. But the only thing they will say to me inside in that house, or if they are going to say anything to me, is, when can I see my daughter? When can we have her home? They're the only two things. Now, at that stage, I don't have the courage to ask them to come in and pick a coffin. Once I get that information off them, you'll never make the funeral arrangements at the first visit. How are you going to ask that family that's in denial to start picking out clothing for this child? At that stage, once I know that they have charged me with the responsibility of getting their loved ones home, I leave it at that stage. And then I travel back to my premises, I contact the hospital, and I get a time of when the autopsy may be over. I then return to the house with a bit of information that they want. I'm bringing her home. I'm bringing them home. And they're happy with that. And at that stage, because I've brought them a little bit of good news, I can move the arrangements on to another step, like asking them for clothing. And they're still screaming at us, when can we have her? When can we see? At that stage, I can get the clothing picked out. And to see a family going through personal effects in the house, and you may sometimes yourself end up in the bedroom of the person that you brought into the hospital. And you look around and you can see all the confirmation pictures, the Holy Communion pictures. You're getting an insight into who the little girl, she might be on a horse. You get to know what the person was into. And this all comes round into your head. So it's very difficult to get into the full funeral. And people understand sometimes they have a difficulty. What's the role of a funeral director? I'm a funeral director and an embalmer. A funeral director's role is to help plan a bereaved family, plan and arrange and carry out a funeral. An embalmer's role is to embalm the deceased, which will eliminate any problems when you bring the person back to the house, which the family has charged you with the responsibility, wash, dress and lay out the body. I am both, I'm funeral director and embalmer. So at this stage, I have brought in the young person. I know there's a lot of facial injuries to the face. And I'm beginning to think, as I go up to that mortuary and drive down to my funeral premises, I'm thinking, are my best efforts going to be good enough today to have this person being able to be viewed and take to the house? That's a big responsibility. So I've often, in car crash especially, I've often had to spend up to 10 hours reconstructing a face. So that, because I'm conscious about what I was being charged with in the house, I've got it. But you can't go into a house and tell them some of the injuries that you just try and fix it for them and leave it easier for them to come about. So we do. And the other thing is, we're not finished at the crash scene. We're involved with this family up to 5 days and sometimes 6 days. We see the pain that they're going through. I'm the one that has to put the lid on the coffin for the last time. I'm the one that has to put that box in the ground. And those are two of the most difficult tasks I think any human being could be asked to do. To put a lid on a coffin, they can never see them, touch them, kiss them, talk to them ever again.
Took a while to settle, get their bearings, but now they look like they own the place. Dylan, across to Richie Feeney. Richie Feeney! Richie Feeney shoots and scores. What a performance. 48 minutes gone. Mayo lead 15-7. And John Casey, surely, there's no going back.
Oh, they have them rattled. Unbelievable. Great play by Alan Dillon again. Seeking Killian Neal at home.
Here we go again.
Yes!
There's 15 men. And the 15 of them are very good. They're a young team going into Croke Park, so there, and they're going to do very well, so there, very well. You're going to see this man and that man and that. We're going in as 15 men, not as one individual, two individuals, three. They have to go in as a team. One man doesn't win a match, and I know it. I scored 11 points in 1969. The score was Kerry 11, Cochrane 11.
Now, will you do us a small favour? Would you lead them in a verse of the Green and Red of Mayo?
I really can't sing. Does anybody sing?
Well, will you start with it and Leo will join in, will you? You have to know. When we got him here tonight, you'll have to do it. What about the band behind me? Have you any...
Does anybody know the words of the Green and Red of Mayo?
Does anybody know the words? I thought you'd know the words, Leo.
I know the words. It's the notes I have a problem with.
Can anyone strum a bit of the green? Can you strum a bit of the Green and Red of Mayo there? Is that too much of it? I'm putting them on the spot now.
Have you got a stringed instrument that I could strum?
No, Leo will do it for you.
A banjo. Woo-hoo. Jesus.
Oh, this is live radio and raw and at its best. Give him a bit of encouragement.
I'm not doing this on my own.
No, you have to help him now. That's the promise. Because we put him on the spot. In fairness, he was coming here to talk about a very important charity gig next week now. And as you can see, this was not rehearsed earlier. Because Leo's having trouble getting the banjo on. Give up on the strap, Leo. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Oh, the green and red of Mayo, I can see it still. It's soft and craggy boglands, it's tall majestic hills, where the ocean kisses Ireland and the waves caress its shore. Oh, the feeling it came over me to stay forevermore, forevermore.
17:15. Oh, this is heart-stopping stuff. Too close for comfort, John. The 10-point lead is back to two. Surely Mayo cannot lose this.
Oh, my God. If I never have a heart attack, I'll have it now. But this is unbelievable, Mike. David Clark, what an outstanding save. Dublin have gone 8 in a row, Mike, without a score from Mayo. We've got to get the ball. All Mayo, they're not winning the ball in the middle of the field and they're making loads of mistakes. And the Dublin team have loads of space inside.
If you're around knock, you know what we need. If you could just pop in and have a quick word with the man himself. 17:15.
We say a special welcome to our listeners on Midwest Radio, whether you're listening on radio or online. We invite you to join with us in prayer today as we gather to pray with and for all who derive their living from the land across the Midwest region and indeed throughout the country. We're praying especially at this Mass for those of you who have been adversely affected by the bad weather of the past few months, and those who feel worried and powerless because of lack of fodder for your animals. We gather in the presence of the God who has given us the wonderful gift of creation and who gives us the grace and strength we need when we feel powerless, when we feel in need of any kind.
We're wearing it because to get to make her see us in the night.
We just did it for Enda Kenny.
Who is Enda Kenny?
Enda Kenny runs the whole country.
The whole country, and is he from around here?
He's from Mayo.
Have you ever met him before?
No.
So are you quite excited about meeting him?
Yes.
He went on the telephone directory in England. He went on the internet, and I knew her name, and I knew the street she was living on. So he went into that area, and he got three numbers with the same name. So I rang two of them. There was no connection there. So eventually I rang the last one, and she answered the phone.
Your mother?
Yes.
How did you know it was your mother?
Well, I don't know. I just got that when I heard her voice. I says, this has to be her.
And what age were you then?
I was 55.
Good God. So 55 years on, suddenly she picks up the telephone and you're at the other end of a phone line.
Yes. So
what did you say to her?
She just said to me who I was And I told her who I was, and she just turned around and said, "What do you want?" And she said, "Oh, yes." She started giving off then. She said, "I told that lady in the agency not to give you my number." I said, "She didn't." I said, "Don't blame the agency for anything." I said, "They gave me no details at all." I said, "This is all my own research with the help of two cousins." And, of course, she knew then exactly who the two cousins was, because they had obviously approached her in a phone conversation as well. And she knew all about it. She knew I was looking for her and everything. And she said, "Just ask me, what did I want?" And I says, "All I want to do," I said, "is talk to you." I said, "After all," I said, "you are my mother." And I said, "I want to speak to my mother," I said. And she was grand. And after that, you know, she calmed down and she was lovely after that. And she started telling me about, asking me, had I a family and was I married? And I says, "Yes." And she started asking me about my adopted mother and my adopted father. And I told her over the phone, I said, I couldn't have a nicer mother or father as I had in my adopted parents. And she was glad to hear that. I'm glad, she said, "You were looked after well," because she said, "I couldn't do it." I said, "I understand why you done it." I said, you were only 17 years of age. You know, I understand that quite well. And I have no regrets, I said, of what you done.
Said that there was a break. She was put into the ward. She was into the children's ward. My partner was with her. I went that evening to see how things were going. I went in. My partner was there, very upset, very visibly upset. And we were told that we were not allowed to take our daughter out of the hospital. And we said, "Why?" At this stage, I didn't want her in this particular hospital. I wanted to move her to the Galway Clinic in Galway to have her looked at, because I felt there was nothing being done for her. And we were told that there was reason to believe that we had been hurting her. Sorry, excuse me, miss. Which was totally outrageous. I mean, we understand that there's procedures have to be done and things have to be done, and, you know, forms have to go through. So we asked to speak to people who were in charge and who were making these decisions, and nobody, the faceless state came to being. Nobody would talk to us, nobody would look at us. My partner and my daughter were put into a room beside where the nurse's station was, so they could be observed and watched. I wasn't allowed to be in. We weren't allowed to take her home. We were told that if we tried to take her home, that the guards would be called. Again, for my part, I said, "Look, we've wrote to you, we've asked you for help, we've told you these things are happening, we've asked you for help." The letter that we wrote mysteriously disappeared. The fact that I had kept a copy of it helped, and then it reappeared again the next day. Oh yes, there is a letter there, but that doesn't do from the fact that we actually feel there's something happening in the home. We were reported to social services, and we were told that we were not allowed to leave the hospital. So after a few days of being there, we said for the weekend, could we take our child home? And we were told no. And we pleaded with the paediatrician. We said to them, like, "Look, this is crazy. Like, there's no way we've hurt our daughter. No way whatsoever." My partner was in the hospital. She spent 3 nights, Tommy, where she never slept a wink. She was afraid to go to sleep because she thought they'd come and take her away.
And you're not afraid of death?
No. Well, I don't look forward to it, but at least I know that there is nothing else for me. That's the next big do. They'll have out of me is when putting me down. I don't mind, because I worked very hard as a daughter, as a pupil, as a wife, and a mother, and a grandmother. I'm thinking I did. So I leave it to them to write my history.
And Delia, finally, what would you like your legacy to be when you're gone?
Well, that I was kind to everybody, and that I never turned anybody down. And no matter where I met them, I always included them in everything I was doing. I never was one to keep a grudge. And there isn't a lot else that you can do. And when you're coming near your end, there's nothing. You have to think of who you're going to face when you face the Lord, that you cannot hide anything from him. And it is well for to be very open with him. and have your peace made with him before you go.